to you. Amen. Okay, so this portion, Vayitse, and he left, is from Genesis chapter 28 through 32. The notes are pretty extensive again, so hopefully we'll be able to get through them. The first section that we need to talk about is in the beginning of the portion, in chapter 28, verse 10, where it says, Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. Okay, so this is obviously the occasion when he leaves his parents' home in Beersheba and leaves to go to Haran, where his relatives live. Okay, so Jacob left, and he left is where the name of this portion comes from. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set, and taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head, and he lay down to sleep. And this is the occasion when he has this well-known dream in verse 12. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth, which with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending upon it. And there above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land upon which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, a obvious idiom for there will be many of them, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. And God kind of affirms what he said to Abraham, to Jacob, all peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you, God says to him, and I will watch over you wherever you go. Now, given what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, do you remember I shared some of the comments of Schofield that in Haran, Jacob, like Israel, was out of the place of God's blessing, but the text says the exact opposite of that here. God tells Jacob that he will be with him wherever he goes, right? When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid and said, how awesome. He wasn't scared, afraid. He was awestruck. Afraid, that's the idea in Hebrew. How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. So the house of God translates into Beit El, the house of God, or Bethel, but it's really Beit El, which is what this place was named. Early the next morning, Jacob took the stone that he had placed under his head, and he set it up as a pillar, and he poured oil on top of it. He called that place Beit El, though the city used to be called Luz. It's approximately 10 miles northwest of Jerusalem. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking, and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear, so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God, and this stone that I have set up will be set up as a pillar will be God's house. And all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. Now, there are a number of things in this passage which would be interesting to discuss, like the statement he makes, if God gives him food to eat and clothes to wear. That should remind us of the Lord's Prayer, what's referred to as the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread. The idea here is that Jacob's needs were very simple, and he was just anxious or interested in having those basic needs met, and he would be grateful to God for meeting those basic needs. And the other thing which is mentioned here is as that he pledges in this passage to give God a tenth of the increase of all of those things that the Lord uses to bless him. And this too is kind of interesting because obviously the concept of a tenth, which we are first introduced to in the story of Abraham and Melchizedek, is not a part of the Torah that God gives to Moses at Mount Sinai yet, and wouldn't be for several hundred more years. But the concept of a tenth, giving back to the Lord a tenth of what he provides you with, right, is an important idea. But we'll leave that for another time. This first comment that I want to talk about is from a midrash by the Lubavitcher Rebbe in his commentary on the Torah. In order for Jacob to begin his own chapter in the saga of Genesis, he had to go out, to leave the material and spiritual comforts of home, not to mention the easy path of simply imitating his father, and face the challenges of a hostile world. Right? So this is an important lesson in Jacob's life. I think it's a lesson which we probably all experience to some extent in our own lives, and all watched as our children went through experiences similar to this in their lives as well. So, the Rebbe goes on to say, only thus, by putting his commitment to the test and awakening his latent prowess, could he mature into the father capable of raising the chosen family, as well as into the patriarch capable of setting the chosen people on its course through history, right? So, challenges are obviously an important part of our lives, in spite of the fact that we don't often appreciate them when we are dealing with them, right? We tend to prefer the simple, calm, peaceful existence that we sometimes enjoy for periods of time. But of course, the challenges are things that God uses to strengthen us and to, to accomplish His purpose in us, right? As difficult as that sometimes is to deal with. At any rate, the Rebbe goes on to say, as it was with Jacob, so it is with each of us. Once we have imbibed the cultural heritage of our past, we must accept the challenge of maturity, setting out to follow our destiny and making our unique contribution toward bringing the world to its ultimate fulfillment of God's plan. Right? An important, important idea. Only in this way can we awaken our latent prowess and utilize our God-given talents and potentials to their fullest advantage. Furthermore, only thus can we ensure that the power God gave us to sanctify all facets of mundane reality manifest itself to its fullest, enabling every corner of life to become His true home. So this is an important principle in Chabad theology, the idea of rendering the mundane holy, right? And doing everything we do in this life, regardless of what it is, regardless of whether or not it's serving the Lord in some formal ministry or serving the Lord in any other capacity, we can turn our mundane existence into something that reflects the character of God, and therefore making it a place where God can dwell. Okay? At any rate, let's move on to the vision, the stairway resting on earth. The reason why I wanted I want to take some time with this one is because it's mentioned in a very interesting passage in the Gospel of John. Okay? So in John chapter 1, verses 43 through 51, the next day Yeshua decided to leave for the Galilee, and finding Philip, he said to him, "Follow me." And Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida, which means house of fishing. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the Torah, and about whom the prophets also wrote, Yeshua of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." So it's interesting the way Nathanael responds to that news. Nazareth, can anything good come from there? And of course, Nazareth, if you have been with us to Israel or are familiar with some of the things that are often said about it, was a sleepy little town in the Galilee, right? Nothing of any significance occurs in Nazareth. It becomes the home of Yeshua. It is where he is raised. It is not far from the Galilee, from the Sea of Galilee, from Tzipori, from some other towns which have played an important role in history, but Nazareth is not one of them. Okay? So it's kind of an interesting statement, and of course there is a prophecy about the fact that this good will come from Nazareth, this quiet, sleepy little out-of-the-way place in the Galilee, which obviously is something which comes to light later. "At any rate, come and see," said Philip. When Yeshua saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, and again, think of this statement in the context of our Torah portion, "Here is a true Israelite," or literally, truly an Israelite, "in whom there is nothing false," right? But that is a dynamic rendering of the text. It should be translated, "in whom there is no guile." Now, when you think of the word guile, or hear the word guile, you should automatically think of Joseph, right? Excuse me, of Jacob. Because Jacob was accused of guile, right? So it's an important connection between Nathanael and Jacob, not about what is said about Jacob, but what the text says about Jacob. There is a big difference between what people said about the character of Jacob, like Esau and Laban, and what the text says about Jacob. At any rate, Nathanael responds to Yeshua by saying, "How do you know me?" Nathanael asked, and Yeshua answered, "I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you." Okay? Now, the fig tree is an important metaphor in Hebrew, but without an understanding of rabbinic literature, there would be no reason to assume that there was anything more significant to a fig tree than there is to a lemon tree or to a pomegranate or to any other type of tree, right? But there are many references to fig trees in the rabbinic literature, and so it plays an important role in really understanding this story too. "At any rate, then Nathanael declared, 'Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel.' Yeshua said, 'You believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree? You shall see greater things than that,' he added. 'I tell you the truth, you shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Okay? Now it's interesting because the dream that Jacob has involves a ladder which stretches between heaven and earth, and the angels of God ascend and descend up and down this ladder. Okay? There isn't anything else said about this ladder in the Bible except for this passage in the Gospel of John where Yeshua says he is the ladder. Right? So it's an unmistakable statement, an unmistakable remez. This is a remez, not a midrash, because it's an allusion, a reference, back to a passage in the Bible that speaks personally about Yeshua or what he has come to accomplish. So there are many other passages in the apostolic writings, in the Gospels, in which Yeshua refers to himself not as a ladder, but on some occasions as a gate, right, which essentially expresses the same concept or the same idea. Yeshua is the bridge between the Olam Hazeh and the Olam Haba, between this world and the world to come. Yeshua is the bridge. He's the one who makes the connection possible. Okay? Now this expression, true Israelite, it is an expression, a term, which was used frequently in the first century of the Common Era. We find it in Acts chapter 2 when Peter refers to the crowd that he is speaking to as fellow Jews and men of Israel and brothers. But the Jewish people in the first century often tended to identify themselves as Israelites. The term Jew was applied to them by Rome, right? And it was actually a bit of a misnomer because Rome considered anyone living in the territory originally allocated to Judea as Jews, even though they technically were not all simply from the tribe of Judah. In other words, in the first century of the Common Era, representatives of all 12 tribes of Israel lived in the land of Israel. Okay? But because the capital of Israel is Jerusalem, in the territory of Judah, the Romans referred to the Jewish people, or the people of Israel, as Jews, even though at the time many Jews referred to themselves as Israelites, as did members of other Israelite tribes as well. It's a term we find in the writings of Paul in many passages. He speaks, for example, in Romans 9 of true Israelites. Who are the true Israelites, for example? This is one of the texts or the passages that many people who espouse a replacement theology cling to or hold to so as to make themselves the true Israelites, right? In other words, the true Israelites are those who truly have a heart for God. So many Gentiles think that they, because they believe or trust that Yeshua is the Messiah, is a member of what is referred to as a spiritual Israel. When in fact, there is no such thing as a spiritual Israel. Unless you imagine that the spiritual Israel is the Israel that is spiritual. because that's what Paul is referring to in Romans chapter 9. In other words, the true Jew, according to Paul, is not a Gentile who embraces Yeshua as the Messiah, right? But a Jew who lives his life in the way that God intended the Jewish people to live. That's Paul's point. The true Jew, or the true Israelite, is an Israelite who walks in God's ways and who loves the Lord in the way that God describes in the Torah. Okay? Paul refers to himself as an Israelite in Romans 11. He refers to himself as an Israelite in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. And then again, he brings this issue up regarding a true Jew in Romans 2 as well. The real Jew is not merely Jewish outwardly, right? In other words, the true Jew is the Jew who is Jewish outwardly and inwardly. That's the idea. At any rate, Paul, who was a Benjamite, also refers to himself as a Jew in his literature, in his writings as well. Right? So, by the time of the first century, the term Jew, first used by the Romans to identify Israelites generally, because of their connection to the territory allocated to the tribe of Judah, right, becomes a term used for all Israelites, first by Rome, then by others, and it's a term which has stuck ever since, and it's even a term which is used in the first century by Israelites themselves, like Paul, who, even though he is a Benjamite, refers to himself as a Jew. Okay? At any rate, let's move on. The word doulos in Greek, a word which means craft or deceit or guile, corresponds to mirma, the Hebrew word which means lackness or slackness or deceit or treachery. Okay? As it appears in Genesis 27. Isaac says to Esau, when Esau comes in for his blessing, Isaac says to Esau, his oldest son, your brother came with guile, the mirma, and took away your blessing, right? So Isaac, in this passage, accuses Jacob of guile, but the fact of the matter is, that is not the way the Bible characterizes him, and it certainly is not the way the rabbinic literature characterizes him either. Okay? In Psalm 32 it says, blessed is the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him, and in whose spirit is no deceit. Okay? And in Psalm 101, no one who practices deceit will dwell in my house. Jacob did not practice deceit. He was certainly involved in one deceitful event, an event which we talked about a couple of weeks ago. He objected to participating in, and only did so at the insistence of his mother, right? But there is a difference in the Bible between engaging in an isolated sinful event and living a life which is characterized by that type of sin. At any rate, no one who speaks falsely will stand in my presence. Okay? So, this idea, while you were under the fig tree, I apologize for moving quickly through the material, but there is an interesting passage in the Mishnah, the Midrash, in several texts. What is the difference between the death of young men and that of old men. Rabbi Judah said, when a lamp goes out of itself, it is good. It is good for it and good for the wick. But if it does not go out of itself, it is bad for itself and bad for the wick. Rabbi Nehemiah said, when a fig is gathered at the proper time, it is good for the fig and good for the fig tree. But if it is gathered prematurely, it is bad for itself and bad for the tree. In this regard, the following story, Rabbi Hia, the elder and his disciples, and some say Rabbi Akiva and his disciples, others say Rabbi Yossi ben Halafta and his disciples, but notice what they did. They used to rise early and sit and study under a certain fig tree. Now, I would love to read the rest of the Midrash, because the story it shares is a wonderful story. But the fact of the matter is that this reference is sufficient for us to understand what Nathanael was doing under the fig tree in the Gospel of John. Do you remember? Yeshua tells him, I saw you when you were sitting beneath the fig tree. The fact is that based upon this Midrash and several others as well, there is a connection in the rabbinic literature between fig trees and Torah. And that, as it turns out, was a place where many people studied Torah. Right? Now, in the first century, that reference would have been understood by the readers of that story, right? That's one of the reasons why Nathanael questions if whether or not anything good can come from Nazareth, because he's occupied with the study of the Torah when Philip calls him. And he obviously misses this reference in the Torah to the passage in the prophets which speaks of the great light which is first going to be manifest in this obscure area of the Galilee, right? So he doesn't connect it to the coming of the Messiah in the way he should, but as soon as Yeshua speaks to him, he makes a connection and recognizes him as the Messiah. There's another midrash in the Talmud, the next line, item B, from the tractate Erusin, which is about betrothals. Rabbi Hia bar Abba, expounding scripture in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, said, "Whoso keeps the fig tree shall eat the fruit thereof." Why are the words of Torah likened to the fig tree? As with the fig tree, the more one tends it, the more figs one finds on it. So with words of Torah, the more one studies them, the more relish one finds in them, the more enjoyment, the more insight, the more depth one finds in the study of the text. That's why you can read a passage a dozen times, 30 times, 50 times, 100 times. As your understanding of idioms and the culture of the first century and of Jewish thought, as your understanding of these things changes, then you will recognize things in texts that you have read over many, many times, and they just didn't jump out at you then like they will or tend to now, right? And you'll recognize connections between things. And frankly, you may not even know what the connection is at first, right? Like this passage from John chapter 1. You'll read a comment that Yeshua makes about the fact that Nathanael is an Israelite in whom there is no guile, right? And you'll think to yourself, guile, guile, where have I heard that word before? In what story from the Bible is the concept of guile important, right? And so you'll be aware of a connection, even though you may not know what the connection is. And then all that you have to do is to start digging. And you'll eventually come up with it, right? From another Midrash, whoso keeps the fig tree shall eat the fruit thereof. This is a passage from the Proverbs. Why is the Torah likened to a fig tree? Because the fruit of most trees, such as the olive tree, the vine, and the date palm, is gathered all at once, while the fig tree's fruit is gathered little by little, which is, of course, the way it is supposed to be with regard to the study of the Torah. So it is with the Torah. One studies a little each day and eventually learns much, because the Torah is not to be learned in 1 or even 2 years. And of course I would say, and not even in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years or 40 years, right? It is still possible to learn things from Torah regardless of how long or how often one studies. Okay? Moving on, getting back to the latter concept. Notice in this Midrash from Genesis Rabbah, the next item, Ben Kapara taught, no dream is without its interpretation, and behold, a ladder symbolizes the stairway set upon the earth. Okay? So for Ben Kapara, he likens the concept of the ladder or the stairway to the concept of an altar. But there are many understandings or interpretations of these angels and what they are doing. Some rabbis associate the angels with the role of the priests in ministering on God's behalf to the people of Israel, and frankly to the nations as well, because at all times during the time when the tabernacle stood in the wilderness and the temple stood in the land of Israel, it was not only possible for Jewish people to bring sacrifices and offerings to the Lord of the temple, Gentiles could bring sacrifices and offerings to the Lord too. They could participate in the celebration of the holidays that took place in Jerusalem as well, right? So, some rabbis think of the angels as the priests, the high priest and other priests ministering before the Lord. There are other rabbis who relate this vision to Sinai and see the angels representing Moses and Aaron and the ministry of those who bring God's word to God's people. But it's interesting because Yeshua specifically applies an understanding of the text, right, that he infuses with his own role, that he is actually the ladder. He is actually the bridge. So it doesn't negate these other concepts or ideas, right? But the fact of the matter is that he is the one who connects the two worlds together, this world and the world to come. Look at this this Midrash from Basikta de Rav Kahana. The verse, therefore, fear you not, O Jacob, my servant, saith the Lord, neither be dismayed, O Israel, a quote from Jeremiah, applies to an episode in Jacob's life when he dreamed, and behold, a ladder and angels of God ascending and descending on it. These angels, according to another interpretation, are the princes of the nations of the earth. Okay? So that's another idea. And of course, we find in other passages in the Bible that God accomplishes his purpose through the leaders he raises up to rule over the nations and the leaders that he removes from positions of leadership over the nations. And then there is an interesting reference to Edom at the end of this midrash. Even if, as though such a thing were possible, you were to see Edom come up and sit next to me, I will have him eventually brought down from there. So even if the ruler of Edom, you know, ascends to heaven and sits next to God in heaven, right? The rulers of the earth ascending and descending on this ladder, he won't be there for long because Edom will be brought low. But of course, there's a passage related to this that says, Rabbi Judah said in the name of Rav, Messiah the son of David will not come until the kingdom of Edom, Rome, will have spread its power all over the world, right? Similar to Daniel's vision of the four kingdoms that would come and go, but the last kingdom, Rome, undergoes a bit of a metamorphosis, but is ultimately the kingdom that extends its influence to the ends of the earth when the Messiah comes. Okay? If you look at this next midrash, it speaks about Jacob and the fact that this passage, he that hath used no deceit in his tongue, applies to Jacob, who said, my father peradventure will feel me. In other words, there is a recognition in the rabbinic material, and certainly in the Bible as well, that Jacob was a reluctant partner in the deception perpetuated upon Isaac. Okay? In this next midrash, it speaks about the fact that the gate, this gate, established between the heaven and the earth, will be open for many righteous to enter, right? And so, in the rabbinic literature, this vision of Jacob is something used to speak of the role that Jacob plays and the people of Israel play in the salvation of the nations, right? A concept or an idea that Yeshua capitalizes on when he speaks of himself as that ladder or as that gate, as that bridge between the heaven and the earth, right? And what's interesting about this midrash from Genesis Rabbah, C, is what it speaks about at the end. It refers to the fact that this gate is none other than the gate of heaven and refers to it rebuilt and firmly established in the Messianic era. Okay? In other words, it will be through the Messiah that this connection between heaven and earth is established. There are many other references here. This passage from the Zohar, from Judaism's mystical literature, is interesting too because it connects Jacob to the ladder. Okay? Now, I apologize for not having the time to go through these very thoroughly. But what's interesting about this passage from the Zohar has to do with an idea that we have talked about before, that in Jewish thought, particularly in the Gospels, like in the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew makes a big deal out of the fact that Yeshua, or the Messiah, is the quintessential Israel. In other words, Yeshua is Israel. And we see this in many of the things that Matthew says, like when Yeshua and his family go to Egypt and then return from Egypt And Matthew says, this was done to fulfill the prophecy in the book of Hosea, which says, out of Egypt I will call my son, or I have called my son. Right? We've talked about this. The fact is, the prophecy doesn't seem to have anything to do with the Messiah, and everything to do with Israel. But the Messiah accomplishes things that occur in the life of God's people as a people, right? Even something so dramatic and direct as Yeshua walking on the water of the Sea of Galilee is connected to the occasion in the book of Exodus, which we'll talk about when we get there, when the Jewish people cross between Egypt and the wilderness, not on dry ground, but on the dryness. In other words, the waters of the Red Sea congeal. That's what makes it possible for them to cross over between Egypt and the wilderness, right? They don't cross over on a dry riverbed. They cross over on the dryness. And that's exactly what Yeshua does when he walks on the water. He causes the water under his feet to congeal. So he is standing on what amounts to be a hard surface, which, by the way, was the hard surface that Peter stood on momentarily as well. Right before he realizes that he's not in the boat, but standing on the water, and then he can't take it anymore, and, you know, he just disappears beneath the waves, right? The point is that these events in the life of Yeshua are connected to events in the life of Israel as a people. But he's the quintessential Israel. He's the Israel that does walk in God's ways and is the one through whom the nations are reached with the truth. In John 10, if you follow your notes, Yeshua speaks about the fact that he is the gate. In this passage, he's talking about a sheepfold which has a gate, and he is the one through whom people enter the sheepfold and or the sheep go out. They go in and go out. But Yeshua is the gate. And of course, and this is the passage in which he says, whoever enters through me will be saved. Okay? And of course, this is an idea which Paul emphasizes in his letter to the Romans, that salvation comes through one man, the Messiah. And of course, it's emphasized in what Paul writes to Timothy, to Titus in his first letter, a passage I'm sure you're familiar with. In 1 Titus chapter 2, there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man, Messiah, Yeshua. Okay? At any rate, I want to move on. Again, I apologize for how much we are trying to cover. But these are important concepts and ideas to discuss. This next section has to do with Jacob and Rachel and the love that Jacob has for Rachel. It's a beautiful section, and I want to talk about something else. So I just want to emphasize the fact that according to this Midrash, a man's marriage partner comes from the Holy One, right? In other words, God is the one who arranges marriages. Now, that is not to say that every marriage is arranged by God, right? because there are obviously occasions when people miss the, you know, God's choice for them, or they make an impulsive choice, and sometimes it's possible that people don't end up with the right partner, okay? But what's interesting has to do with the fact that in the rabbinic literature, that, as it turns out, is one of God's jobs. God is in the business of connecting people, and he provides opportunities for us to meet our mates, or the mate that God intended for us, right? So this is an important idea, of course, that has to do with being sensitive to the things that God is trying to accomplish in one's life and recognizing the potential that exists in a marriage partner, and the idea that God is every bit as involved in creation today as he was when he created the universe in the beginning. In other words, there are those deists, for example, who believe that the world is like a clock that God wound up in the beginning of time, and he puts this clock on a shelf, and then time elapses, and this clock measures the time, and the clockmaker is no longer involved in the way time elapses in the world that that clock is placed in, right? There are many people who have that view of God, that he's not very involved in the world, that he created the world, but that he hasn't been involved in it ever since. The Bible tells a completely different story, that not only is the Lord our matchmaker, but he is the one who sustains us and cares for us and provides for us. He is the one who upholds us and is the one responsible for holding everything in the universe together, right? So he is essentially the glue that holds everything together, something that Paul refers to in his letter to the Colossians. Okay? So one final idea I would like to talk about. Another problem text. Now, Levan had two daughters. If you look at chapter 29, verse 16, you got to keep flipping through your notes. I apologize. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak, or tender, or soft, or delicate eyes. Right? You have probably read this passage. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel had a lovely figure and was beautiful. So her eyes aren't even mentioned. Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, "I'll work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel." Laban said, "It is better that I give her to you than to some other man. Stay here with me." So Jacob serves 7 years to get Rachel, but notice what it says. But they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. I can't think of a person on the planet who would not like or not appreciate this character of love being expressed toward them, male or female, right? The idea that Jacob labors 7 years for Rachel, and those 7 years, without pay, by the way, just room and board, right? Those 7 years just seemed like a few days to him. They went by that quickly, right? And of course, the only thing that made it worthwhile was the fact that he was in Rachel's presence, right? That's what made it worthwhile to him, that he got to spend time with her. I mean, You know, we don't know anything about their courtship or about their relationship or about what they did together. And frankly, it's irrelevant. The fact of the matter is that Jacob's heart is characterized as so full of love for Rachel that the 7 years he worked for her seemed like only a few days. And after he is tricked by Laban in the same way he tricks Isaac, his father, he works for Rachel for another 7 years, right? So he works for her for 14 years. That's how long he spent in Haran before he got to marry Rachel. Now, obviously the situation with Leah and Rachel, there are a lot of things about the relationship that we could be critical of, right? But it's interesting because in the text, it characterizes Leah's eyes as weak, but of course there is no explanation. But the rabbis do provide an explanation for it, which I think is interesting. Leah's eyes were weak from this midrash in Genesis Rabbah. Rabbi Yochanan's Amora translated an Amora is a sayer, a teacher, translated this before him, and Leah's eyes were naturally weak, said he to him, your mother's eyes were weak. But what does rakot mean? That they had grown weak through weeping. For people used to say this was the arrangement. And it's interesting, because according to the rabbis, based upon what the Hebrew says, and the tense of the Hebrew verb, Leah's eyes grew weak over time, right? In other words, something takes place in Leah's life before she marries Jacob that results in her having weak eyes, or tender, or soft eyes. And according to the sages, it was because Leah was originally promised to Esau, and Jacob, or Rachel, was promised to Jacob, right? Because Esau is the oldest son of Isaac and Rebekah, and Leah is the oldest daughter of Laban, right? So there was an assumption in those days, just like Abraham sent his son Isaac to get a bride from among the members of his own family, that would be true in Esau and Jacob's case too. They would both be sent to Haran to acquire brides. Leah was designated to be the wife of Esau, and Rachel was designated to be the wife of Jacob, right? But Leah weeps because of what she heard regarding Esau's character, that he was a wicked man. And so she weeps before God and prays that God would somehow prevent a wedding between her and Esau from taking place, right? And as it turns out, that's what happens, right? Now, it's a midrash, obviously, but it is an interesting story. The next passage goes on to talk about the 7 years that Jacob worked for Rachel. And, of course, I connected that to passages in the apostolic literature about not becoming weary in well-doing and not losing heart when you're confronted with difficult circumstances. Or me too, obviously, right? I mean, at some point, we have to the best of our ability, fix our eyes on what the Lord has called us to and try to press through whatever difficulty we experience in life. Not an easy thing to do, obviously, but an important thing to do. And finally, you can read this last section on your own. I talk about the meaning of each of Jacob's children's names and why they were named what they were named. Like if you look at the last section in the text in your notes. When the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. And Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuven. Behold, a son. Why was Reuben called Reuben? Because the Lord has looked upon my affliction. Surely now my husband will love me. Right? So what's important about this section, and the reason why I delineated the meaning of the names of each of Jacob's children, is so that you would have a sense for the reason why people are named what they are named in the Bible. Right? In other words, a name isn't picked out of a hat in biblical times. You know, in biblical times, an individual might be named after someone in the family who was admired, right? But of course, there were really no celebrities then, so people weren't named for famous people or famous celebrities or characters from a novel, right? I mean, in biblical times, people were named because of something connected to their birth, right? The purpose for their birth, the hopes or the aspirations that a parent had for a child, something that reflected the character of the child. That's why people were given the names they were in biblical times. And by the way, that's why Yeshua was named what he was named. Yeshua means salvation. He was named salvation because he would save his people from their sins, right? It's a very simple connection. Isaac was named Laughter because Sarah laughed when God promised that she would have a son. Israel's name is changed from Jacob to Israel because Israel means he who wrestles with God and prevails. Because he struggles with the angel of the Lord and prevails against him. Although you might be hard-pressed to understand in what way Jacob actually prevailed against the angel of the Lord, given the fact that he was crippled for the rest of his life. Right? At any rate, these ideas are important. And finally, at the end, I have a brief comment about the mandrakes, which the rabbinic literature says very little about, apart from the fact that they were considered to be a bit of a love charm in biblical times, which is evidenced not only by our passage in Genesis, but by a passage in the Song of Songs. Okay? So, with that, what I figure we got through, what, 60% of it? I apologize. Comments, questions?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I thought that Jacob had been given a Rachel before he worked the second set of 7 years. He was given Rachel by Laban in the expectation he would work the additional 7 years, 14 years in total. But I got the impression you were saying that he received Rachel only after 7 years to enjoy the marriage.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he was, that's a good question. It is not clear, actually, what occurs or how quickly the marriage to Rachel occurs, because on his wedding night, after the initial 7 years, he wakes up in the morning to find that Leah is in bed next to him, right? So there is some question as to whether or not the marriage to Rachel occurs at the end of the additional 7 years or occurs right away, and he just works for 7 more years. Because he's in Haran for 20 years, right? He's there for a very long time. I kind of ignored that. I can look at that and get back to you and see if there is a consensus on it. Okay? There you go. I can hear you now.
Okay. I continue to be amazed at the connections that are constantly being made. And just the, like you said, as you go back and reread things, that all of a sudden other things pop in your mind that you can connect to. So it's very amazing.
Absolutely. But the important thing is, I appreciate you saying that, but the important thing is there is no detail in the text that isn't important, that it isn't possible to make a connection with, right? I mean, they wrote, especially in the Gospels, they wrote very, very deliberately and included the stories and the details that they did very deliberately, right? Their objective was that their audience might understand the connections in the detail. And that would be a powerful testimony as to the identity of the Messiah, right? But those connections are what makes the... We tend to evaluate information in a very different way, right? But in biblical times, the credibility of information was based upon its connection to a Torah concept. It had to be based to a concept in the Torah. And so that's what authors do, right? They essentially connect details in the story of the life of Yeshua to biblical events, because it is those events that attest to the veracity of Yeshua's message, right? In addition, obviously, to what he said and to what he did. But for Jewish people, it's a very powerful issue with regard to credibility. Yeah, Joseph.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Matthew and I were having a discussion earlier this week about the Torah portion. I don't remember if it was this week's Torah portion or last week's Torah portion, but something that was kind of interesting that the comment that he made, and it's not related specifically to either Torah portion, but kind of on the lines of what somebody had mentioned earlier, and you had kind of expounded on a little bit, was that the ages of the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I don't remember exactly, you know, one was 175 or 180, but they were all over, I think, 135, 37 years old. So when you combine the length of their lifetimes, you have close to 500 years of life, and yet the Bible only records certain, you know, a few detailed events of their lives, and it's interesting, being that, of course, we believe that this is inspired by God, that these particular events were chosen, the ones that were chosen, and it's like, why, what is the importance and the significance here, the lesson or the message that we are supposed to get, that God provided these details out of so many other possible details in their lives or events in their lives. So, you know, when the rabbis say that not only are the stories important, but the words and the letters and the spaces between the words, they're significant that God chose these specific events to relay a message to us. And it's, and you mentioned about reading over and over and over, and every time you can get a new understanding or a passage can speak to you in a different way. I think it does that because of the, I guess, profound significance that these events were chosen to be revealed to us. So it was an interesting insight. So I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It is an important insight because we actually know very little about biblical figures, including Yeshua, right? We know virtually nothing about his life until he's 30 years old, except for except for we know a few details about his birth. We know a few details about what occurred in his life when he was a toddler, a two-year-old, right? When he's living in Bethlehem with his parents, and Herod kills all the children, the male kids, 2 years old and younger. We know something about when he's 12 and he comes to Passover in Jerusalem with his family and stays, but we know virtually nothing about his life. We don't know anything about the life of Abraham until he's 75, right? His story starts when he's 75 years old, right? So the point is a very important one, that the stories that are recorded for a reason. But it's interesting because it works both ways. The stories in the Hebrew Bible, in the Tanakh, inform information that is provided to us in the apostolic writings, right? And it makes it possible for us to connect concepts and ideas that give the text its power and its authority and its breadth and scope, right? That's what makes the Torah, or the Bible generally, that's what makes it such a rich, rich area of study, because it becomes our responsibility to take up that challenge to find out what these connections are, right? Why are these stories here, right? You have to remember that all of the stories we're reading about now, they were recorded for the Jewish people as they stood before God at Mount Sinai, right? This history was recorded by Moses at the Exodus from Egypt, right? So he covers hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of history that he wasn't alive for, right? But the stories that he includes in Genesis and Exodus, right? In the beginning, I mean, we catch up to Israel at Mount Sinai in Exodus, in the book of Exodus, right? But all of the book of Genesis occurs before anybody who left Egypt was born. Right? So you have to wonder, why does Moses include the information he does include, and why did he omit so many other stories that he could have included and didn't? Right? It's an important, important idea to contemplate. Right? Because what we have because of the connections, like Charlene was saying, right? These connections. That's part of what we do, is try to understand those connections. Ed writes, Wayne said it was an interesting study. I appreciate it. I agree. And Ed adds, thank you for the study, the wonderful study. The implication of Nathanael under the fig tree was that he was studying the Torah when Yeshua saw him, right? Yes, that is the implication of that statement. This is interesting. The nature of the fig tree given continuously when being tended is a very useful connection to the benefits of continual study of the Torah. Absolutely. That is an important application of the biblical connection, or the rabbinic connection, between the Torah and the fig tree, right? And it probably helps if you like figs. Like me, I love figs. Yes, Joseph.
Well, I don't like figs. Is that why I struggle so much to understand?
No, it probably has nothing to do with it. But the lesson of the fig tree is an important one.
Yeah, that's a great one. I never heard that before.
Yeah. Yeah. But when you think about it, I mean, I don't know how many of you have fruit trees in your yards, but, you know, fruit trees, they do. They produce all of their fruit at once, for the most part, right?
Yeah.
Flowers, too. You know? Flowers, you know, they, it's like 1 week there's no flowers, then the next week your yard is full of them, you know? It's just amazing the way it works, but not with figs. Yes, Michael.
You're talking about producing fruit, and I happen to think about how you call Yeshua the quintessential Israel. And I thought it was a very appropriate way to describe him. It reminded me a great deal of how we say that in the bosom of, or I should say, in the loins of Abraham, there was Jacob, or Israel. And so we are in Yeshua. We are in Israel also in the same sense.
Absolutely.
That was the connection I saw.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, the connection that Michael just mentioned is a really important one in Paul's writing, especially when he's writing to Gentiles and speaks of the connection that they have to God's house or God's people in the Messiah, right? It's an incredibly important idea in Paul's literature. In Paul's writings, Gentiles who embrace Yeshua as Messiah, they are connected to Abraham. They become the children of Abraham by faith. They are adopted into the family of Abraham, right? I mean, look at Paul's metaphor of the olive tree in Romans 11, right? Natural branches and wild branches being grafted side by side in the olive tree. That's another way of expressing the same concept, right? So that, forgive me for saying it this way, but Gentiles who believe in the Messiah do not make up a church, not in the Bible. In 4th century Christian theology they do, but not in the Bible. In the Bible, in the apostolic writings, Gentiles are connected to Israel, right? Not a body that replaces Israel. That notion would have been completely foreign to what a Jewish person believed in the first century, especially Paul, right? Paul's usually the one credited with the church, but he had absolutely nothing to do with this notion. Because in his teaching, Gentiles are in Abraham by being in the Messiah. Right? Important, important idea. Okay. I guess we'll call it a night. I appreciate you all sharing your afternoon with me. And I just pray that the Lord would bless you with a wonderful Thanksgiving. There will not be a Thursday night study this week, because it will be Thanksgiving. But there will be a Shabbat study, and so I encourage you to participate. Hopefully that will work out for everyone. And by the way, next week, not the Sabbath after Thanksgiving, but the Sabbath after that Sabbath, we're going to see the way the meaning of a text turns on the spelling of a single word in Hebrew. Exactly what Joseph was alluding to. There is theology even in the way words are spelled in the Bible. And that's something that we'll talk about in two weeks, right? But at any rate, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Have a wonderful Shabbat. And may the Lord bless you with a wonderful, wonderful week this week as you give thanks to the Lord. Okay?